Today is Sunday, January 13th, 1985. My name is Tika Ward. I am interviewing Sally Moss. Our topic is Lou Tate and the Little Loom House, and our interview is taking place at the Little Loom House. Sally, currently you are serving as president of the Lou Tate Foundation Board of Directors, Incorporated. Tell me of the past positions you've held and how long you've been involved with the board.
I came on the board the first year that the foundation was formed. I didn't start with the board, but I filled an unexpired term. Charles Moberly was the original director that I replaced, and his obligations were to do publicity and the newsletter and that sort of thing. So I came in to fill like half of a year of his term, and I was delivered into the sending out of the newsletters, doing that sort of news releases and all that type of thing. Then the following year I was the vice president of the board of directors, and Lee Ebner, I think, was the, now wait a minute, let's see if I've got that right. I'm not certain now that I think of it. I think the next year I may have just remained on the board. Then I think Lee Ebner was the president and I was the vice president. And then the following year I was the president and continued as the president for 2 years. Then last year I was the executive director, and this year I'm the president again. So you might say I've sort of come up through the ranks. I wasn't on the original board because I was having a baby.
I was going to ask you why you weren't on the original board, because your relationship with Lou Tate goes back almost further than anyone who's currently serving on the board now.
I would say yes, that's probably true. I wanted to be in on all the, well, I visited Lou when she was dying in the hospital and I was pregnant with my son Ethan. And we sort of had a sad joke between us. She had some stomach problems, which complicated her health problems, and her stomach was distended. And she was joking with me about she bet she would have her baby before I did. And so it happened. She died before I had Ethan. I had Ethan shortly after she died. And then, of course, I missed out on all the ceremony and so forth, but that's how it came to be that I wasn't on the first board. I was recovering from childbirth.
Tell us when you first met Lou Tate.
I met Lou Tate through a mutual friend, Hal Tenney, who was also a board member at one point in the foundation's history. I was a seamstress. I had my own shop. It was called Ah Sunflower. It was right next to Hal Tenney's shop, the Portacall.
And what year was this?
That was in, when I first met Lou Tate, it was about 1968. And I was introduced to her because I wanted to find more interesting fabrics to sew with. And so Hal Tenney said, why don't you just go see Lou Tate, because she could teach you how to weave those fabrics to sew with.
And this was your own shop that you had, and it was located
at 131 West Main. And it was a small women's custom dress shop with little imported scarves and jewelry and that sort of thing. But most of it was handmade clothes. And my husband gave me a loom for my birthday the year before we were married. And that sort of led me into the textiles thing. So I would come out to the loom house every Wednesday. And Lou would sometimes give me a lesson, but sometimes I'd wind up sorting threads or sweeping the porch.
So it was Hal Tenney who said, you really ought to meet Lou Tate.
Yes.
Because she has all kinds of
weaving expertise.
But did you have that little loom at that point?
I think it was all sort of simultaneous, actually. It just was a happy coming together, serendipity kind of thing, which it just pointed me toward her. She never got rid of me after that.
Do you remember the first time you came?
Yes, I I came up to see her. I didn't know what to expect when I got here. I knew she was a really famous weaver and that she was well known throughout Louisville, and I didn't know anything about weaving at the time, so I just, you know, people would say, oh yes, Lou Tate, she's really something. She is the woman to ask about weaving. So I came out here expecting, I don't know what, but I found this really charming, rather eccentric woman with a little Dutch haircut and kind of some, a couple teeth missing in the front, and very, very outspoken and kind of brusque, and but yet with a real sense of joy to her. She was, you know, she'd get giggling about something or that sort of thing, which intrigued me. You know, I thought she was fascinating, and I just picked up that she was the kind of out front person like me, and so I said, look, I can't afford to come out here and get you to teach me to weave because I don't have any money. And she said, well, that's all right, I don't have any money either. What can we do? And so I made her some clothes, some jumpers, and she designed them. She told me what she wanted. She said her dressmaker of many long years had just died, and she had no one to make her any clothes. And so if I would make her these jumpers out of denim, she liked, because it was very soft and easy to move in, that she would in turn teach me how to weave. And so over the years, I'd make her things, and she'd, you know, teach me things.
Did they have pockets on them?
Oh, that was the biggest prerequisite about anything she wore. It had to have pockets, because she always had one of her little hand-woven purses with a Velcro across the top. She had one of those in one pocket. In the other pocket, she had pens and pencils and little scraps of paper with notes. And sometimes you'd see her and she'd have a note pinned onto her shirt with a straight pin, only it was upside down. So when she looked down at the note, she could read it. And it was funny, people would come out, we'd be out here working, and she'd have one of those little notes pinned on her shirt, and people would be talking to her, and as she'd be talking with them, you'd see their heads sort of starting to turn, you know, so they're trying to read what was on her note that was so important, she would pin it to her shirt. But anyway, she'd get a kick out of that too, I think. But she was the kind of person that she always was making notes. She had little pieces of paper everywhere, which is what we find even now among her archival materials, or those little notes.
Did she ever decorate the pockets?
Oh yeah, that was one thing that she would ask me to do, would be take a certain coverlet design that she had woven in a square and use that as an embellishment on her her jumpers, was to sew these coverlet pockets onto her jumpers and make them more attractive that way.
Did she ever visit downtown where you worked? Did she ever come see your shop?
I don't think so. I don't recall that she did. She may have, maybe once, but it probably was in conjunction with an art show that Hal Tenney had. She didn't very often go around. She was mostly the kind of person that she had a purpose, she had a solitary direction she was heading in, and most anything that didn't concern that, weaving or textiles or coverlet research or anything like that, was just, you know, extraneous. She had tunnel vision. She would go downtown to get her pages printed. She would ride the bus, she would carry these heavy stacks of papers and things, but she, you know, as socially, she didn't have a whole lot of activity in that way that I know of. Perhaps she did and I didn't know about it, but I'd say there wasn't a lot of it. Most of it was people coming to her, especially toward the end of her life when she wasn't well. You know, then everyone just expected. She was like the guru. You'd come and bring her oranges, or you'd come and bring her fruit or things that she liked to eat, and then in return she would sit and talk with you. And it was, I would refer to my teaching lessons as, I'm coming today to pick your brain, which would indicate to her that I didn't want to sweep the porch that day. I needed to know something about something I was doing at home on my loom or something. And so then we would get into a discussion, or sometimes we would sit in her kitchen, which was a very high honor if you got to sit in her kitchen, you know, because most people weren't even allowed into the lower house. They just met at top house and that was it. But sometimes we would sit in the kitchen and she might have some wine, and we would sit there and have a glass of wine and She would smoke a cigarette. She used to smoke a lot. She was quite a smoker. We had little sardine cans around the edges of the top house and down in her house and in Esta, where she would use them for ashtrays. We also used them to put the nails in for the looms and different things that we needed, but mostly they were little ashtrays, little Vienna sausage cans and things. And people write to us even now and ask how the loom house is doing, and do we still have the sardine cans and windowsills and things like that. But we would sit in her kitchen and talk, and a lot of times she would just, she'd answer my questions if I would persist about weaving, but a lot of times we just spent just talking about what was going on with her. She had a long battle on her boundary dispute on one side of her property, and we talk about that.
This might be a good time for you to describe, you've referred to a bottom cabin and a top house. This might be a good time for you to describe the cabins.
Well, the property is basically about a half an acre on a slope up the side of Kenwood Hill, and the bottom part borders on Kenwood Hill Road, and the top part of the property is on Possum Path. Then there's three cabins peppered up the hill, and the lower cabin is called Esta, and Lutate told me the meaning of that word, and I'm sure that maybe Sue Kendrick might remember it, but it's written on the door in the cabin, and we know that's its name. It has to do with art, I believe, but it was named before she came there. She always referred to it as Lower House, but if people would push her, she'd say, yes, it was Esta. And that was where she lived. That's where she camped out. That's what we used to refer to her house as, because it had no central heat, had a big fireplace, which she didn't use a lot. She had electric heaters here and there. But mostly she stayed, in the wintertime, she stayed down there. She wouldn't come up to Top House, and that was her house. She didn't do much cooking. She had a little hot plate. She'd warm up some, instant coffee water on it or something. Most of what she ate was TV dinners or fruits, or she liked grapes a lot, I remember. And
did she eat the sardines? Is that why there were so many of those cans?
Yeah, she ate that. And she collected banana boxes, too. So I'd take her to the grocery sometimes. Then I'd see what she'd buy. She'd buy pretty much convenience food. She wasn't really into food that much. She just mostly wanted to do her work. And if it was less time preparing food, then it was more time that she had to do her work with. So,
and generally when people came to see her, they would come to Top House, which is where we're interviewing right now.
Right. Well, they knock on the door at Lower House to let her know that they were there, and then they would head on up, and then she would go up afterwards, because she wouldn't make a habit of staying at Top House. If she came up, it would be, for a long period of time. She would, I don't know how to explain this. People would come, or if she knew they were coming, she would go to Top House, and she would work up there, but when she was finished, she would go back to Esta. She didn't make a habit of going up and down the hill a lot of times, because it's a pretty steep climb, and it was tiring for her. And as she got older especially, she would not come up here days in a row. She would mostly stay in Esta, unless it was in the summer. Sometimes she'd have a day bed up on the porch here at Top House, and she had her desk spread out on the front porch on the top level, and she would have all of her materials up here, and she'd just sleep up here during the summers. I guess that's where the sardines and stuff came in, because we had a refrigerator up here originally, and she'd keep things in the refrigerator up here. And so if you came for a lesson, you could bring a soft drink or your sandwich and stick it in the fridge, and it wouldn't, have to worry about the heat getting to it. But mostly she stayed in Lower House during the winter, and that was really an ordeal. She had a lot of her personal possessions, things that were in her family, her parents' china and silver and crystal and that sort of thing was all in the shelves in the Lower House. And then in front of those shelves, she would have these wonderful coverlets all hung up in front of the shelves. So you couldn't tell actually what was on the shelves, but all the coverlets just lined the whole bottom cabin over the top of those shelves. As a matter of fact, I wasn't even sure there were shelves all the way around, because usually you couldn't get in there. There was just a path. She had loom tables set up all through the living room area where the big fireplace was, and down the hallway with papers all over them. And there were just stacks and stacks and stacks of papers. And there was only just a very narrow trail that went in between them that led to her bed, which was in the living room there. And the rest of the house was just filled with just research work and papers and everything. It was just stacks and stacks, and you couldn't tell what in the world was going on, except that there was an area by the window where she had her drawdown machine, which was a piece of glass that had light underneath it, and she would take the coverlet pattern, and she would, by projecting the light up through the coverlet, she was able to draw down her drafts, and that was how she did a lot of them. You know, the research of translating the drafts onto the written graph, written down onto the graph paper in a visual way. And then she, of course, had the patterns drawn down in the traditional form on the grid there, and also in the four-line traditional manner that most weavers use. But she actually worked from the original fragments that people would bring to her, and a lot of times she would be preparing things to take to the printer, and that's where she worked, was right in front of the big window there in Esta. And then her typewriter and everything would be in the kitchen, because that was the warmest place. Right now it has holes in it, but at that time it was the warmest place. And so she would be out there working and typing, and it was next to the hot plate, and she could have her coffee and whatever. So that was her office.
We also have a middle cabin, and what is it? Well, originally, what was it used for?
Well, that's Wisteria Cabin. And originally it was a summer house before Lou Tate acquired it. It was used as a summer house. It's like a dog trot cabin, which means it has two double doors that open and into a central hallway, which has double doors that open at the other end. And there's rooms off to the right and off to the left, and a stairway that leads up to the attic. And that was originally like a little meeting room place where the original Little Loom House members would come. There was a little sofa and little chairs and things, a charming fireplace. It was like a little meeting room. It was probably originally the living room. And then behind that was the kitchen, and it eventually became a storage room. And then on the left side of the cabin was a long, a single long room, which is right now is completely ruined. The roof is caved in. It's anything that was in there is now ruined, but it was a storage area.
Lou did not spend time in there as she did in bottom house or top house.
No, it was open to the public during our open houses, and sometimes we'd have exhibits in the hallway. At one point, we had all our spinning things there, all the spinning wheels and all the samples of wool. We had a friend in Canada who would send us different bags of colored wools and rovings and things like that. We stored all that there because it was more convenient for us. And
when you would sit with her in the kitchen and you would talk with her, tell me some of the things you all discussed.
Well, I wouldn't say they were discussions, really, in the sense that we both talked a lot, because mostly it was me sitting there listening to her talk. And I wish at this point I had a tape recorder like this to put there and just listen to her talk, because she would go from, she didn't really talk about herself in a personal way. She never said, I have a niece, and she's doing this and that, like we might converse about our children or anything. She mostly talked about the Loom House, what was going on with restoration. She had a preservation account that at the bank, which we would always contribute to. When I would do volunteer work for her, we would have Girl Scouts come out, and we would charge them like 50 cents to weave, and 25 cents she would give to me, and 25 cents would go in the preservation account. So we would talk about the preservation account and if it was going along. There was never any figures mentioned. It was just, we knew it was there. We were trying to contribute to it. We talked about programming. She would say what she hoped to would transpire that year in terms of open house series, when we would have certain people come up. I think it was probably me that got her started into the spinning, because we would talk about that a lot. And when I was gone a year from the Loom House when we lived in Wisconsin, my husband was an instructor at Layton School of Art and Design in Milwaukee. And while I was up there, I studied weaving with Mary Drudis Porter, and she got me interested in spinning because I needed some interesting yarns. So when I came back to Kentucky, I was all excited because I wanted Lou Tate to become involved in spinning too. She, of course, declined. She'd been through this before. I mean, she knew all about spinning. It wasn't that. She just said that, once again, the tunnel vision was in effect. She was weaving, and I could be spinning if I wanted to, and she would go along with it. And we ordered these Ashford spinning wheels and had them shipped over. And we gathered around us because of that spinning program, which was in about 1972, a group of people who were very interested in spinning and mostly just spinning. And those people later, this was just an aspect of the total Loom House to Lou Tate. This wasn't something that she was interested in developing, because there wasn't that much to it. Not like spinning where you could trace the not like weaving where you could trace the historical aspects back to 1779 and that sort of thing. Spinning was just, it was a craft. It wasn't the art that weaving was. So the people that got as far as they could get at the Loom House in spinning then broke off and became the Fleece and Flax Guild, which a lot of the people that are members of that guild are also Little Loom House members as well. So
we have a picture here, which is of you in front of Wisteria Cabin.
That's me.
With a spinning wheel. Now, was that...
That was right when we first started the spinning program. Lou Tate had a walking wheel there, and that's what I'm spinning on, is a walking wheel. We had a spinning bee where we invited everybody in the state that we could think of, and out of state too, that would know anything about spinning. And this picture was taken shortly after that spinning bee, when I learned spinning on the walking wheel from Sarah Bailey, who's quite an accomplished spinner in Pine Mountain, Kentucky. She came up and gave a lot of her time and eventually formed her own a spinning bee at Pine Mountain, Kentucky. Many of us go down there every year. I went the first year, but children came along. It was hard.
The spinning was something that you all added to your open houses, to
right.
which you've referred.
Right. We had several spinning open houses, spinning bees, where we would have a person, Bob Eubank, came up one year with a lamb and sheared it and gave the kids a real thrill, and we laid out the fleece and sorted it, and then we had an auction where we'd auction off the fleeces to see whose fleece would bring the highest bid. And it was very exciting. It was a lot of fun. Lots of good spinners came. Brother Kim Malloy from St. Meinrad's Arch Abbey in St. Meinrad, Indiana, came. And I think it was through him that I really polished off my spinning. And I really got down to where I felt like I was a good spinner. Because I tried... every spinning wheel is different, and you have to get used to your own wheel. And it was through him, I think, that I got it down to where I felt like I could teach it to somebody else. And then after that, I sort of became the spinning teacher in residence for the Loom House. If Lou would have a group come out, she would say, I'll teach you the weaving and Sally Moss will be the spinning teacher. So we sort of worked in conjunction in that way, and that made a nice program, and it was fun.
When you all would sit in the kitchen, you did say one of the things you discussed was the boundaries. And I get the impression ongoing questions concerning the
right.
boundaries.
Because of the antiquity of the cabins and the the tracing back into when the state was first formed, this particular parcel of land has a great and fascinating history behind it. I don't know if you want me to go into all of it, but there was a stone quarry at the top of the hill, and stone was brought down the path or the roadway that we now consider our driveway, and the bottom house, Esta, was the caretaker's cabin for this stone quarry, and it was the man who lived there who built the other two cabins. Later, after the stone quarry was not used, the other two cabins were used as summer houses, and the cabin we're in now, Top House, was the last cabin to be built. And then Wisteria was the middle cabin, and of course Esta was built as his house. All of the cabins, I think, except Wisteria, have had additions since they were built originally. The lower cabin had the kitchen, was the addition put onto that. And of course, part of it is now decayed away. There was a sun porch on top of part of Esta that's gone now, and also a walkway from the second floor down over where she used to store her oil barrels, and then down into the parking area, which was really very charming, and we do have some pictures of that. And also the exterior was changed. It used to be vertical pole construction, and now it's board and batten. So maybe someday we'll have the finances to peek under there and see if we can get it back to its original state.
She would discuss with you then the things like the boundary, the preservationist fund, and then she would discuss with you her drafts, perhaps.
Oh, yes. Well, I want to go back to the boundary a little bit because during her lifetime, she spent almost, I think it was about a year in court trying to settle the boundary as you look at the cabins on the left-hand side. And the developer who built the other cabins around, who built the other homes that surround the cabins now, these ranch-style houses that move up to our borders, he was kind of an unscrupulous character, from what I understand. He changed all the boundary lines on any existing properties that were on Kenwood Hill to his own benefit so he could build more houses. And when I first met Lou Tate, she was attempting to put a definite boundary on that left-hand side because this developer was ready to fill in the natural drainage area, which is located on that side. It's a regular dip in the hill where all the water runoff came. He wanted to fill that and put another house over there. And I know for a fact several foundations have shifted that he built in this area because him just taking the bulldozer and just flattening everything out and then plopping a house down there. Well, Lou Tate was not the kind of person that was going to sit still for anybody encroaching on her property. So she was involved in a lawsuit to determine the boundary on that side. And finally, by virtue of the dear little outhouse that sits over on that side of the property, which we jokingly call our fourth historic building, by virtue of that outhouse being there, the boundary line was definitely placed beyond that point. And that was the winning the winning thing that kept it from slipping away from her grasp. So that boundary was settled before her death. Then, of course, she had the slipping and eroding hillside, which was also another happening because of this builder's need to develop this wonderful old wooded hillside. He went to the top of the hill, bulldozed that down flat, and of course with no trees holding the land, it started to slip. And the Hill House, which is another log cabin building, historic building, which is right above us on Possum Path, Hal Tenney, the man that had the port of call, was living there. That's how he knew Lou Tate, because they were neighbors. He was the owner at the time of the erosion, and woke one day to find that his foundation had literally been washed out from under him, and there was like a 2-foot gap there on his porch that just happened over a few days, and big boulders were rolling down, and he became very frightened. And during this time, Bob Douglas and several other friends of Lou Tate's had gone to the city and begged them to do something about this slippage. And through several false starts and then starting again, eventually, right about the time Lou Tate died, the construction began to build a $500,000 retaining wall on the opposite side of Possum Path to keep the hill from eroding any further. And it was a great coup for us because we thought, we had no idea that the city would be so benevolent, and I really can't say enough in their behalf because they've been very supportive of the historical aspects of the whole.
This is side two of my first interview with Sally Moss, and we were discussing the boundary dispute.
Let's see. I think that the boundaries were finally resolved on the left side to the benefit of Lou Tate, and she retained that drainage dip, which is quite a good piece of land. Then the retaining wall was built, and wasn't completed until after her death, but it was built at the cost of $500,000. That left us with the boundary on the right side, which after the foundation had been in existence for a few years, one of the people that owned the property on the lower corner near Esta Cabin one day came over and parked his truck in our driveway, what we call our driveway, which is actually the road that led to the rock quarry. And one of the people that was working here got into quite a heated argument with him about leaving his truck in our driveway and blocking it. So what happened was he decided to bring suit against us in order to gain rights of access to his own property, which he claimed was a pie-shaped piece of land which stuck out from his property and went underneath the entry to the road. At that point, we were in the middle of a CETA summer project whereby we were doing some basic landscape cleanup work and that sort of thing. And we used the balance of that CETA money to put new rock down on the driveway, therefore establishing that we had indeed maintained the roadway. We provided upkeep on it. Now, the man who owned the property next door at that time was named Paul Stearman. I went over and talked with him and found him to be a very nice person. I think he just got off on the wrong foot with this other person that he was talking with, and so the lawsuit established that we indeed would have right-of-way to that roadway, but never determined exactly where the boundary was. So, to make a long story short, he sold his property. He established the boundary to be where he thought it was, which cut across the front of our driveway. The people that bought the property, the Siegels, the Siegels, excuse me, they deeded over that corner of the property to the Lou Tate Foundation as a goodwill gesture, and also since we're a nonprofit organization, they could take this donation off their taxes. And now we do own that corner of the property. However, the boundary line goes off in a rather diagonal direction, which leaves another property at the topmost right-hand corner of our property, which is owned by a couple named Hollis, who are claiming that the boundary line goes right through the corner of the top house cabin, which is to me ludicrous because these cabins have been here since the 1800s and they just built their house about 20 years ago. So I don't see how they could claim any of our property. However, we have had to come to terms on what we're going to do on that situation, and the board of directors is now endeavoring to make some definite and legal statement as to where the boundary line is on that site. So poor Lou Tate, her boundary line problems carry on even posthumously. So now we're endeavoring to get that straightened out. But this hill and these cabins have been here so long, and originally this was the passageway for the buffalo as they were going to the salt licks, and that's what Kenwood Hill Road was a buffalo trail. And of course, where the buffalo went, there also went the Indians. And as the Indians passed this way, then they would have the hides with them that they would need to tan. And so Kenwood Hill was flat on the top, and the Indians called it Sunshine Hill. And because it was flat and treeless, it made the perfect place to lay the hides down and cure them and prepare them for use. So that's, we find a lot of artifacts here on the hill as well. And we want to make sure that as long as there's unscrupulous developers and disputes and all that sort of thing, that what property that we still retain retains its historic flavor, because we have some huge oak trees that are on our property. We're gradually losing them, but they're hundreds of years old, and Lou Tate referred to them as the mighty oaks of Kenwood Hill. And so we want to make sure that if we lose some of these mighty oaks, that we will have the right and the privilege of planting more oak trees to carry on this tradition.
Did you learn some of this when you were talking with Lou Tate in her kitchen?
Oh, yes. She loved history. She was a history major in college, and she just loved anything that had to do with history, that had any kind of historical implication, and that was the basis for her interest in weaving, I feel positive, because she was good at the craft. I mean, she studied weaving at Berea. She was nimble-fingered. She was very, very pleasurable to watch. I mean, she was nimble in threads with her fingers. But I think that the biggest thrust of her interest, especially in her later life, was the research of the drafts. And she had, I mean, even now we find mailing lists in nooks and crannies of the cabins at different points in time. She kept in contact with hundreds of people about coverlets that were in their family, or they were interested and wanted more information, and she just didn't simply lay down the pattern. I mean, anyone could draft a pattern if they had the training, but she actually endeavored to go back and find historical documents in families. She was very interested in following the development of a pattern through a family from when they first immigrated to this country through the present time. What happened? Why did they bring this pattern with them? What were the historical happenings at that point in time? Why was the pattern named this? Who was the daughter that received the pattern from the parent? How was it transported? What hardships did they endure when they endeavored to bring these patterns along with their treasured possessions of their family? It was fascinating. She just gave me, before she died, a piece of a pine bloom pattern. And I still have the fragment, and she was working on this pine bloom pattern. She was doing research for herself. She was doing it for the mailing list that she kept up, and she also was corresponding with some kind of educational institution in Texas, and I have not been able to find the name of this. I assume it's a university, but she was doing some extensive research work for them, and it involved a lot of historical information. We have some pages in our archives that she published on the Snails, Trails, and Cat's Tracks pattern, which was a pattern that was brought over right at the time of the American Revolution. It's one of the earliest patterns she had, which was probably why it was so fascinating to her. And she wrote down everything she could find out about it, including a correspondence from a young lady who had come to this country, and her sweetheart was fighting in the Revolutionary War, and what was happening with the captain at that point. And it's just really fascinating reading, even for anybody who doesn't care to look into weaving as a craft or an art, just to see all the history that goes behind all these patterns. The mother would write the pattern down so carefully on a strip of paper, then she would roll it up into a little roll, and we reproduced some of the original drafts by duplicating them at a printer, and then we rolled them up, cut them into strips and rolled them up and gave them out to visitors to the loom house at one open house so they could get the essence of what we were talking about. Lou would explain the story, and then she would say the women would come to this country and they would have very few possessions because they would obviously come on boats and so forth. They would take their little strips of paper that were rolled up and they would put them in their jewelry boxes with their most treasured things, you know, their antiquities and goodies for the heirlooms and things, would carry these boxes often, you know, on their persons. And that was one of their most valuable things. When they came to this country, they could begin weaving because they had their patterns with them. Even though they had no looms, no threads, no shuttles, and no spinning wheels, they could always make them or find a man to make them for them or get some craftsman to reproduce these looms and other equipment. But they had to have those patterns, and so they carried them with them like their treasured possessions. And that was something that Lou Tate was very fascinated with, was the evolution of these patterns, how they might change a little bit through each generation. They might improve them, they might alter them, they might do something different in their weaving. But a lot of the weaving, of course, that women did was very utilitarian, like diapers, like bed sheets, underclothes, hand towels, things like that. They wove a great deal of, but these coverlet patterns were something that were the culmination of the craft of the weaver, because they would be the decorative bedspread that would adorn their beautiful bedrooms that they were proud of. Something that showed your skills was these coverlet patterns. And so Lou Tate traveled around extensively in the Kentucky area and in northern Tennessee, sometimes on horseback, gathering these patterns up, and people would know she was coming, and even they sometimes would not be aware of what it was that she was getting. They would say, "Oh, you mean those papers that look like that singing song music?" And so they would refer to her as the lady who came for the singing song music. And they would drag out their drafts and either let her copy them, or sometimes they would give her the drafts. And she inherited some drafts from a weaver that she studied with, because the weaver saw that she was a person that was going to carry on with this research. And so she inherited some drafts that way. And so we have a really large collection of original weaving drafts on very old paper, very parchment-looking paper that's very yellow and all drawn out in very precise little ink lines and so forth, of these original weaving drafts. And unless they have a year written on them, it's, you know, it's hard to discern when it was, but it's certainly antique-type material.
The titles also reveal something about the people who were...
Right. A lot of times, the titles were reflecting something that was happening historically, like Bonaparte's retreat, Wellington's march on the field of battle, Whig rows for the Whigs and the Tories, that sort of thing. A lot of times reflected what was going on historically, and oftentimes would have humorous overtones, like we have one pattern in our archives here that's called Bonaparte's March Across the Rockies, which was, people were hearing, "Oh, Bonaparte's marching here and there. The next thing we know, he'll be coming over the Rocky Mountains to get us." And so that was kind of a humorous tilt to the pattern names. And it's real interesting.
Did the women do most of the weaving?
Well, there was two distinct groups of weavers in this region, which makes this a real fascinating point to study history from, and the weaving history especially. We were located on the river, so a lot of goods could come down the river. Cotton, notably, would be grown in the south, shipped up the river, spun in the mills, and fooled the wools and so forth, and then brought back. So it was a good place for commercial weavers because they could readily have access to these materials off the river boats. But it was also a settler's kind of a state, you know, Kentucky, old Kentucky and Tennessee. Those were places where you went and you homesteaded, you know. So there was these two groups of weavers, the professional weavers and the what we call the home weaver or the woman weaver who wove the utilitarian goods. Now the professional weavers are what we see in two groups. We see them as jacquard weavers, which are basically the very exciting and colorful birds and baskets of flowers, and they always have a corner with the weaver's name and the date. They're very easy to identify. We don't have too many of those in our collection because they are very desirable as antique items because they have the date woven right in them, and they're beautiful, and they are very sturdy. They're wool and cotton, and so there was quite a few of them around. These weavers would be in an area, and the people would come to them and say, weave me this pattern, or what pattern do you have now, and weave this for me. And they were run very much like a computer. They had punch cards. Children would sit on the top of the loom, feed these punch cards into the loom, and then the weaver would sit and weave. And that was the jacquard loom, sort of the forerunner to the computer. It has a fascinating history also, and a lot of people that study jacquard weaving almost exclusively, and a lot of people that we've had correspondence with do that and are very unnerved to hear we're not that much into jacquard coverlets. However, there were other weavers who traveled around with their looms on their wagons, and these were professional weavers also. They were men weavers. There were several in this particular region, like a Mr. Keene and others, who would put the loom on the wagon, drive into a region, post bills saying, I will weave coverlets for this much money, contact me here, and I will make your beautiful bedspreads for you for this much money. So then people who lived in these little towns and things would have access. They could go to this weaver, have their linens woven or their coverlets, and you know, have something new, different, some pattern which might not be indigenous to that region, or something that was more exciting. And that would be another type of a weaver who could go places where the jacquard man couldn't go, you know, or he might weave in that region for a while and move on. And they were had a little more mobility. Then the third group, which is what Lou Tate was interested in, was the women weavers, and those were all weaving from their homes. They might have woven for other than their family, but they all wove at home. They either wove in their homes or they had their own loom houses, which was quite common for a big landowner's. He might have his home, then he might have another house off to the side, a carriage house, and then he might have a loom house. And then the person that wove on that that farm would have their own place and could do their dyeing and weaving and spinning and all that sort of thing away from the household. And that's, I'm sure, how the evolution of this loom house came upon us, is because having a little loom house is a very common thing back in the days of when things weren't readily bought or easily come by. They all had loom houses. So those were the women that Lou Tate researched, was the women who wove on their own in their homes and produced these beautiful coverlets. Sometimes they sold them to other people, you know, or gave them as gifts, wedding gifts, and that sort of thing.
You were saying that she had coverlets hung up in her house, the bottom house where she lived, Esta.
Right. She had collected a number of coverlets just by virtue of buying them or having them given to her, or even when she began her weaving, her professional weaving career, she wove reproductions of these coverlets, which were taken from the original drafts and rewoven, like in 1938, 1939, around in there. They were woven just like the original ones in two panels with a seam up the center, and were sold as a money-making venture to bring in funds for herself. She was a professional weaver at the beginning of her career, producing draperies, any kind of woven goods like that that anyone might want.
Tell us some more about the contraption, because I don't know enough to know what to call it, that was near her window that she used
to draw down the drafts. Well, she had a lot of magnifying glasses and a lot of graph paper and that sort of thing, but this contraption was it's the same effect as holding something up to a window and the light shining through it. She could put the paper on top and draft it down. Then she could get the treadling and the threading sequence by looking at the actual woven piece and then translate it into a graph type, more precise precision kind of a drawdown, she called it. So when you wanted to produce it again, putting it on a loom, then you would have your actual graphed item, and she translated that through, and also copied patterns from other pieces of paper, where she would just draw in the blocks where the overshot panels are and then black them in, and then later go back and be able to count how many passes of the shuttle and so forth would be in there. It's kind of hard to explain without actually seeing.
What did she do with these drafts? You said she had mailing lists, partly people to whom she wrote, but she also had other kinds of mailing lists, similar to the newsletter that you were in charge of when you
first came on the board of directors. Many, there were like press releases and newsletters and a letter from a friend and just information sheets and so forth that would say, maybe all on the same sheet would have the history of a certain weaving pattern, what went on at the loom house that month, who was visiting, who got married, why something was important for us to remember to do, what activity would take place in the city that she thought we should be mindful of. It was just like a real fascinating, I used to read them, every single word of them. And sometimes they'd have a couple pictures, and sometimes it would just be a typed letter there toward the end of her life. There was several just flat out pleas saying, you know, the cabin is deteriorating, I'm not able to spend as much time doing this or that. But these newsletters which is the big charm of them to me, is because they are not only the history of the research that she was doing, it's also the history of the loom house cabins, what was happening there, what people were there, Frank Lloyd Wright, Eleanor Roosevelt, the man who invented Velcro, which is a story she evidently told me but didn't tell anyone else, which was the, this is just what she told me, and I have no way of documenting it, but she said the man who invented Velcro that we use even today on our little woven pieces, he came for a visit, and she took him for a hike up to the top of Kenwood Hill, and he got those little stick tights stuck all over his pants, you know, and he was impatiently picking them all off, but looking at them very carefully, too, and saying there ought to be some way that this could be put to use. So evidently, he studied up on it and developed Velcro and sent her some packages of Velcro. And that's how we came to start putting the Velcro strips on the top of our little coin purses that we have when we go to these art fairs and things. Because when I first started coming up here, I'd never even seen Velcro. I didn't know what it was, and that's, I would say, this is interesting, and then the story came from that. But
And on her pockets, too. Didn't you say that she would sometimes use this Velcro when she was first giving you the directions on the jumpers?
No, mostly her things didn't have any closures on them that she wore. This sounds crazy, but she liked to pull it on over her head. She didn't want any zippers or any buttons or anything. It was like when I said she designed them herself, she did. There wasn't a pattern. It was just she wanted it to have a waistband, but it shouldn't be too tight. She wanted it to have big pockets, but they couldn't be down too low. She wanted it to have a scoop neck because she didn't like anything up around her neck. And she liked to wear men's shirts, so she wore men's shirts underneath her jumpers. And then when it got really hot weather, she'd wear pull-on shorts, or pull-on things with no closures on them. She didn't like, you know, futzing with stuff. Buttons were about as far as it got. But I never really saw her really dressed up.
She also used to, in addition to the typewriter, write things by hand a lot. Oh, we see her inimitable handwriting.
Very distinguished.
And easy to read.
Mm-hmm. Not bad, really, at all. I have a lot of letters from her. We corresponded the year I was not here. And also, due to the fact I live in Fern Creek, and she was here in, you know, Beachmont, South Louisville, Iroquois area, I couldn't always get out, especially after the babies started to come. So we did correspond quite a bit, and she, I know, corresponded with many other people on many subjects, but a lot of it is very, toward the end of her life, is very poignant.
I was going to ask you about that. When you think about meeting her the first time you were here, and you look at all those years, what was it like? How did she change?
I think that she, because of her dedication to the Loom House as a historic area, and because of her, just her person, she was a very high energy person. I could understand exactly why she came to be an independent like she was. She received no charity from anybody. To my knowledge, she never received a grant that she wrote for herself. She didn't go seeking gift money from anybody. If she asked for money, it was because she wanted it to preserve the cabins or to, you know, carry on some historic tradition or something that was just absolutely necessary. But she was a very independent person. She was a very self-sufficient person. She had that tunnel vision, that single-mindedness. She didn't have time to get married. She didn't have time to, she had fun, but as she grew older, there was less parties. We used to have chili suppers a lot. She liked chili a lot, had this secret recipe for her chili, which was a real popular event. We used to have barbecues. We didn't have those as she grew older. Less activities that were carried on, except we always had cookies and pink lemonade. I mean, that was the big trademark for her. Whenever we had an open house, we always had pink lemonade. Usually, well, then there weren't so many convenience things, so we would have the lemonade with the grenadine syrup in it, and everybody would enjoy that very much. And sometimes after the children left, somebody would spike the lemonade or bring some wine, but you know, it wasn't a rowdy kind of a thing. It was just, you know, old friends sitting around and that sort of thing. And I think that her social life sort of became centralized around the Loom House. It wasn't a go out and get your fun thing. It was more work to have more parties. And so there was less of that as she became older. We had less open houses. She would write me poignant letters saying, I just don't have any energy this week. I don't see that I can keep the Loom House open to the public next summer. If you want to do an open house, let me know and we'll work it out. If you can be out here in time to get things in order or to sweep up or that sort of thing. As she became less well and older, things started to slow down considerably. But it wasn't until the last maybe 5 years that started to happen. She was very energetic and Like I said, started that spinning program up in 72. We dragged looms out to the state fair and did exhibits. We went to Bashford Manor and had a coverlet show, and all of them were working exhibits. They were hands-on. If a child came up and they wanted to weave, you got up and the child wove. It wasn't any sitting there at a beautiful exhibit with a rope around you, dressed in a historic costume with your hair coiffed and just so. It was, go there to teach, go there to pass it on. She was like all the weavers that came before her. You passed it on, you passed the tradition on, and even though it's, you know, not weaving for your own benefit because you need woven goods, it's weaving passed on because the teaching of it and the learning and the historical experience for the children was so important. And that was something that she instilled in me. When we worked together and she was teaching me, we spent one whole summer her teaching me how to warp, because she wanted me to be able to tell it exactly right. She had me write a weaving page. She wrote a weaving page. We worked on that one whole summer. Just the warping of the loom, setting it up, which is just a little corner of what she approached weaving in a very methodical way, making it easy for different age groups to absorb it and to carry on the technique. And she wanted us always to explain the historical significance of the weaving, make it as interesting as possible for children, so they would become absorbed in it, so they could have the feeling of accomplishment from weaving and feeling good about knowing the process and just having a better understanding of what it was their ancestors had to go through to obtain a piece of cloth or to, you know, for those clothes to eat.